Can't get enough of America's undocumented anchorman? SteinOnline.com is your one-stop shop for all things Stein. Catch new episodes of The Mark Stein Show. Sit back and experience features like Stein's Song of the Week and Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time. Get the most of Stein Online by joining the Mark Stein Club, a global community of people just like you. The show never stops for members of the Mark Stein Club. Head on over to steinonline.com/club for details.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. May 21st, 2025. It is 3 p.m. in Washington, D.C., where Trump just made his opposite number, Cyril Ramaphosa, sit through a montage of clips of South African blacks threatening to kill South African whites, followed by scenes of hundreds and hundreds of roadside crosses. 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where hours after a judge declared that Tommy Robinson was to be freed within days, the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Metropolitan Police has entirely coincidentally decided to press new charges against him for harassing two men last year. Not in London, where the Metropolitan Police has its principal jurisdiction, but in Cyprus. Cyprus. 9 p.m. in Hoofddorp, about 5 minutes from Amsterdam Airport, where two people are dead after the regularly scheduled diversity stabbing of the day. 10 p.m. in Jerusalem, where Prime Minister Netanyahu has said that Israel has, quote-unquote, probably killed Hamas leader Mohammed Sinwar. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran, for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. 12:45 in Kathmandu, for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers. Sorry about that. 6 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. 8 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more civilized hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. 100 years ago today, May 21st, 1925, Busoni's opera Dr. Faust, unfinished at the time of the composer's death, was given its world premiere at the Sächsische Staatstheater in Dresden. As I said, 20 years ago, we live throughout the West in very Faustian times. Maybe we'll do that in Tales for Our Time, or maybe I'll play a little Busoni on our music show. Let us get to your questions. Patrick Gagan, I hope I pronounced that correctly, says, Mark, I hope you're doing well today. Did you happen to catch President Trump pantsing Cyril Ramaphosa? I just mentioned the pantsing of Cyril Ramaphosa. I'm absolutely stunned again. First it was Zelensky and now Ramaphosa. If any of your listeners haven't seen it, I absolutely implore you all to watch. Yeah, I love the way Trump uses every lever, which is the American way, which is the non-American, I can't remember, uses every lever or lever at his disposal because he's supposedly the leader of the free world, the most powerful guy on the planet. You don't think he is if you're a district court judge, but the president of the United States matters, and therefore everything he does matters. So these rather tedious things he has to do all the time when other presidents and prime ministers fly in to see him. And there's some of them, as you saw with Biden or whatever, there's some of the most bored. Biden had his great friend, the Australian prime minister, next to him and couldn't remember the guy's name. So Biden didn't use them to any purpose. But one of the great things is that Trump understands that because he controls, quote unquote, Congress, that's to say his party is in charge of the House and the Senate, and yet the asses don't do anything. The lazy asses, is that what it's called? The legislative branch doesn't do any legislating. So he has to use every other lever or lever at his disposal, and he certainly does with these boring things where the president or prime minister of who gives a stan flies in, and they just utter bland platitudes at the press conference. Trump uses all of these very purposefully, and he's absolutely right to call out Ramaphosa on this. So I was, and in fact, the only thing he did wrong when J.D. Vance started hammering Starmer on free speech in Britain is that he didn't go hard enough on Starmer. They should have absolutely clobbered that little bastard because he's one of the most evil men on the face of the planet. And the things he does kill people. So I would like to see, you know, they all want to get their like 20 minutes of FaceTime with the leader of the free world. So they all jet in and do this thing with him. And they should know when they do it that it isn't just going to be the usual platitudes, that if he's got something he wants to shove up their butt, he's going to shove it up their butt. Alison Castellina says, regarding your statement that Lord Ahmed is, quote, in the club and Lucy Connolly is not, this is the difference. There's this wanker of a judge. I think he was our Brit wanker judge of the day, Lord Justice Holroyd. And he has decided that there was nothing that was manifestly unfair about Lucy Connolly getting 8 months in jail for every hour that her tweet was up. This is an awful man, this Lord Justice Holroyd guy. And at a certain point, it should not be safe for these fellows to walk the streets, because there is no justice, as I know, and as others know, to be found at the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand. Terrible thing to have to say. But it's unfortunately the case. Lucy Connolly got 8 months for every hour that her tweet was visible to the public. Lord Ahmed buggered the bollocks out of a 9-year-old boy and a girl who was, I believe, just a couple of years older. And this guy, Lord Justice Holroyd, deserves to be more famous. Lord Justice Holroyd cut 3 years from that guy's sentence and sprang him from jail, because it was all a long time ago. So, according to him. So Lucy Connolly got a longer sentence for her tweet than Lord Ahmed did for buggering the bollocks out of a 9-year-old boy. Lord Ahmed is one of these Taqiya Muslims that Tony Blair put in the House of Lords. He's from Rotherham, right? It's amazing how well you do if you're a Muslim from Rotherham. It really is extraordinary. But he's from Rotherham and he got into the House of Lords, and then it came out that he'd buggered the 9-year-old boy and raped a girl who was a couple of years older. And so he went to, I believe he sodomized her too. Yeah, you need to know what kind of company you're keeping if you find yourself in the House of Lords tea room. And Lord Justice Holroyd sprang him from jail, knocked 3 years off the sentence, but isn't prepared to knock anything off Lucy Connolly's sentence. Do read the interview that Mrs. Connolly gave to our friend Alison Pearson in the Telegraph today. That's what that's in reference to. Alison goes on, I would like to know, you say Lord Ahmed is in the club. I would like to know which club you mean, the Carlton, the Athenaeum, the Hollowed Out Alp Club. I assume that the club, he won't be in the Carlton because he's a Labour pair. I assume the club that puts together politicians and the judiciary is the Privy Council. Lord Justice Holroyd PC is a Privy Councillor, as were the Lords of Appeals sitting on the recent Prince Harry case. Apparently Lord Ahmed never was a Privy Councillor, though many peers are. As for removing peerages, apparently it cannot really be done. No, knighthoods are removable, which makes sense as things are. No, you can't be stripped of a peerage, and nor should you be, in my view. The problem is that Lord Ahmed has one of these ersatz peerages, a peer who, as the 14th Earl of Hume joked to me many years ago, Lord Ahmed is one of these life peers, which means the peerage expires upon his death. So it's really just like a super double plus knighthood. But the 14th Earl of Hume, who was Prime Minister as Sir Alec Douglas Hume in the 1960s, and he had this little amusing little 14th Earl type joke about life peers. He said a life peer, life peer is one who doesn't pass on when he dies. I miss the Britain of jokes like that, but it's dead. Anyway, knighthoods are removable. Yeah, the guy who looked after the Queen's paintings, he had his knighthood stripped from him on the grounds that he happened to be a Soviet spy. So you can lose a knighthood, but you can't lose a peerage. Knighthoods are removable, which makes sense as things are. VIPs, famous people and peers escape the penalties that those on the lower rungs of the ladder pay in full. I think it's worse than that now, because there's always been an element. A lot of things are about class. But now we have a situation. Lucy Connolly is rotting in jail because she has the wrong politics. Tommy Robinson is rotting in jail because he has the wrong politics. The January 6th crowd were rotting in jail because they had the wrong politics. The Canadian truckers had the wrong politics. The eight guys denied the right to leave Germany. Germany, after German unification, they apparently moved the Berlin Wall to encircle the whole unified country. So they were denied the right to leave the country. Those eight guys heading to the remigration summit in Italy, they managed to sneak out and go on stage. And they're quite right to do that, because that is a law that free societies do not have. As Mrs. Thatcher said many years ago, you know, if you need to put up a wall to prevent people leaving your country, you're doing it wrong. And so they managed to sneak out. And then upon their return to Germany, the border guards were waiting with giant printouts of their faces, these eight guys, and promptly arrested them. So that's what the two-tier care thing is all about. In America, Canada, you have the two-tier. It's even more shameless in the United States. We all know, for example, that if Comey had still been in the United States government and someone had put 86 followed by the numeral of the president, then the SWAT team would have kicked down the door at 3 a.m. He was invited in for a little bit of a chit-chat, but we have the former FBI director, he now says, oh, my life has been ruined just because I went for a walk on the beach with my wife. No, you didn't. You went for a walk on the beach in which you arranged seashells into a theft. And by the way, people can point, oh, well, you know, people threatened this guy and threatened to 86 that guy and 86 this guy. Trump is actually the survivor of two assassination attempts in which Comey's pals in the deep state let the one guy get close enough to have a bullet graze Trump's skull. They want you dead. You know, I think it takes a while to recognize this because, I've been around parliamentary systems where people have friends on the opposite side of the aisle. The whole basis of the system that I grew up with, there's a reason why the other guy is called the leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition, is because although you have different political platforms, in a more fundamental sense, you're on the same side. Nobody believes that now, because they're making it. Starmer has killed people. You know, Starmer throws the book at tweeters, and some of them get driven to death, sometimes by suicide or some other way. He wants to. The judge thought, said, okay, we're going to release Tommy Robinson from prison. And within hours, the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Metropolitan Police have decided to charge him because two men claim he threatened them in Cyprus. This isn't on the sovereign base areas, which is, I was going to say that sovereign UK territory, which it is. But the Metropolitan Police don't have jurisdiction there. That's the sovereign base. So even then, it would be the sovereign base police. It wouldn't be the Metropolitan Police. So they basically, these guys who can't do anything, if your cell phone's stolen, if your car's broken into, if your house is burgled, if you're raped, if you're murdered, these useless Brit wanker coppers have a clear-up rate of 1.4%. God rot them. But they've got time to bring charges over two guys claiming to have been harassed by Tommy Robinson in Cyprus. They want to break him. They feel they can, if they kill Tommy Robinson and if they kill Lucy Connolly, it's very hard to take. I don't think a lot of people understand what it's like, particularly if you're like Lucy Connolly, if you've got children. She's lost her business. Whenever they let her out, all the people who were, she had a child minding business, and all the people whose children they looked after, you know, she's in jail, so they got to find someone else to mind the kid. And so when she comes out, she'll be her husband is already suffering because half the family income's gone, so he's had to sell the family car. But Lord Ahmed, who likes sticking his regenerative organ into 9-year-old boys, he's out walking around. It's an evil country. Evil, evil country. But the point is, it worked. They've thought it through. They've gamed this out. Everyone disowns Tommy Robinson. Look at the Reform Party. They refer to Tommy Robinson and his crowd as that lot. And Nigel Farage, for some reason, feels he has to keep saying Tommy Robinson won't be permitted to join Reform, even though Tommy Robinson's never expressed any interest in joining Reform. And we know that you can't, you know, it's the Reform's the most exclusive club in London. Rupert Lowe didn't pass muster, so he couldn't be in Reform. Ben Habib, these guys went to all the right schools. And they still can't get into Nigel's private club. So the authorities in the United Kingdom have figured they can, let's say Tommy Robinson comes out a vegetable. by the time they're through with him. Because you just think what they've done to them in the last 24 hours. Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. I'm getting out of solitary confinement. Oh, wait a minute. Just before we hand you back your shoelaces and all the rest of it, unfortunately, there's been a bit of a complication. Because they picked, by sheer coincidence, they picked the day he was freed by a judge to announce that they're charging him with this new crime. It's almost like they had that in their back pocket, just in case they needed it. There's no equality before the state in that evil crap hole of the, whatever it's called now, the United Emirate of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So it's one law for Lord Armad and another for Lucy Connolly. Just awful. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're well. We appear to have entered anarcho-tyranny in the United Kingdom. I can think of no other explanation for the continued incarceration of Lucy Connolly over a deleted post on X than that. This is beyond two-tier justice, and I can think of no other explanation. Can you? Keep well, Mark. Well, anarcho-tyranny is an American expression. I forget who coined it now, because the place you always read it was vdare.com, which I miss, because Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, who liked to tweet that no one is above the law. Well, she's above the law. She broke the law, federal law, when she was trying to buy some rental property. She declared her dad as her husband. If you're finding it hard keeping all these new kinds of relations straight, Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota, married her brother for the purposes of immigration fraud. And Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, married her dad for the purposes of a bank financing application, because the rates are more favourable if you apply for it as a married couple. So that's what she... And she also declared that her place of residence was Virginia, when in fact she's Attorney General of New York, and you cannot hold office in the state government if you do not live in the state, which is pretty reasonable. It would be tough for her prosecuting Trump in Manhattan if she's living in Virginia. So she's like Comey, though. She's not going to be going to jail or anything. Anyway, I was just talking about that. I got diverted there. Everything is getting a bit like three men in a boat, three men on the bubble now. Digressions. Because here's the point. Anarcho-tyranny is where one side can do anything they like. And that's true for half the population in America, whether you're an MS-13 gangbanger or you're the lawless Attorney General of New York State, or you're the assassination-threatening FBI director like James Comey. You are policed with a very light touch, whereas if you're a law-abiding citizen, every aspect of your life is monitored and regulated. And we saw this very clearly just 5 years ago, at a time when state governments in America were telling people, I know, you can't have grandma around for Thanksgiving. It's not safe. You've got a social distance. Oh, I know grandma's taken a turn for the worse and she's now dying in hospital, but she's got to die all alone, unsurrounded by tiresome loved ones, because otherwise, there's a risk that she could infect you or you could infect her. And at the same time, there's mobs on the street, the Black Lives Matter crapola, which was another racket, and they're all rampaging around non-social distance. It's a non-social distance riot. When they go down to burn Wendy's, they don't say, "Okay, well, I'll be on the eastern side of the Wendy's, and you go out and round on the western side, and that way we'll be properly socially distanced when we set it alight." They didn't do any of that. The anarcho-tyranny, it applies to everything. I first wrote about that over 10 years ago when some guys from New Hampshire, some kids, went to compete in a bagpipe competition in up in Quebec. And coming back at the border post, their bagpipes were confiscated because the U.S. Department of Fish and Fish and Agriculture, Fish and Game, apparently they regulate bagpipes. The bagpipe, as far as I can tell, isn't either a fish or a moose or any other kind of sentient creature, but U.S. Department of Fish and Game has metastasized to regulate it. We now have that in, as Chris Davis said, that has now spread anarcho-tyranny is basically the model for the future. Every aspect of your life will be, this is why it's all going to be destroyed, because every aspect of your life will be ever more crimped and constrained with micro-regulations on everything. While at the same time, if you step outside your front door, the streets will be full of rapists and stabbers that have just been admitted to the country as the shock troops of anarcho-tyranny. And the point to remember is they're prepared to kill. They're prepared for Tommy Robinson to die in prison. And you think, well, okay, Tommy can be a bit brusque for my tastes. I can understand why they don't like him at the BBC because they're all terribly cultured and civilized chaps, and he's a bit of a diamond in the rough, as we used to say. So people say, oh yeah, if Tommy Robinson dies in prison, well, you know, it's a bit of a shame, but they will not, they will absolve the government from culpability. And now they say, well, okay, it's not just Tommy Robinson. Lucy Connolly's become a little bit famous because her husband's a local councillor, and we all know what major celebrities they are. If you go to the VIP lounge at Heathrow, it's all local councillors in there. So she's got to be made an example of, because everyone who dies discourages 1,000 others. So we learned during the January 6th incarcerations, every so often when people would commit suicide, you know, nothing happened. There were no public protests because people saw what they did. You were 67. You'd led a blameless life. You were a devoted mother and grandmother, and they took everything and put you in jail and threw away the key. All those god-awful DC, corrupt DC judges. So there was no, that's why the truckers were in Canada, because in America, nobody wanted to do any. Nobody wanted to do any protest. Oh, I finally paid off the mortgage of my $200,000 home. And there was another guy a bit like that, and he lost everything after the January 6th thing. So throwing them in jail and throwing away the key worked. Same with Trudeau when he froze your bank account because you made a $20 donation to the Canadian truckers. That worked for him too. So Starmer looks around at other G7 nations and figures, yeah, I should be doing some of that. That's the only way to keep the revolting masses in line. And they think it like that in Germany. Oh, yeah, and like some of these people, we don't mind, they wouldn't be happy with Tommy Robinson leaving the country and getting to another country where he had a megaphone. But they understand that with certain people, like, oh, yeah, these eight people thought they'd go to a remigration summit, did they? Yeah, well, no remigration in Germany. In fact, you can't even migrate out of the bloody country. They're all doing it now. And so, again, you think about that. It's like the COVID, where suddenly every government except Sweden does the same things. Well, on this, it's an ever-lengthening list of countries that are doing the same things. America, Canada, Britain, Germany. How many more do you need? Theresa Maupin hope I pronounced that correctly, says she quotes my line because he's in the club and Lucy Connolly isn't. Wow, this says it all. If one veers off the path of the Uniparty, justice will be swift and harsh. I kind of wish Trump would make a comment about Lucy in order to humiliate Britain. Fear itself is playing a new role in this once great country. You're right about that, and I don't know whether Trump will say something about it, but J.D. Vance likes to weigh in on this particular topic. Britain has departed the realm of free speech. Sir Keir's ministry is basically at war with its own people. Years ago, who was it? It was one of my GB News colleagues, Neil Oliver. Neil Oliver said that governments around the West were basically the abusive spouses of their citizenries. And that's absolutely true, and it gets truer every day. Fran Lavery says, do you think that Tommy Robinson's legal entanglements with the UK government will go on and on and on even after his release? Well, as I said, these new charges put in question whether there will be a release. Would you recommend that Tommy seek asylum here in the USA with his family? And would the UK government be sorry to see him go, since they use him as their number one example of their authoritarian powers? Well, I don't think they'd be very happy if, say, he went to the United States and, someone gave him a talk radio show or whatever. I don't think the UK government would be. I think what they'd want to do is for him. What they want is for him to die. They don't particularly care how he dies. Maybe he dies a long, slow, lingering death because his brain's been fried. By the way, all these people saying, oh, we need to be in the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court, I learned this lesson during my difficulties with the Canadian Human Rights Commission. At one time, I was just musing. I was advised to do so by a Toronto human rights lawyer who's to complain to the UN Human Rights Council, which is all, Sudan and Saudi Arabia. But they love an opportunity to stick it to Western nations. And the governments of Western nations always very upset when that happens. So it seems to me that the cruel and unusual punishment to which Tommy Robinson has been subjected actually is in breach of the European Convention on Human Rights, and that it would be, it's a bit late now, but it would have been a good idea for such a petition. But the point here is that I would not normally. I think if you're in his situation, and I was thinking about this with Salman, with respect to Salman Rushdie the other day, who's just pulled out of this graduation ceremony at Claremont McKenna College in California. He's lost an eye. Some crazy Muslim, 4 decades after the Ayatollah issued the fatwa, leapt up on stage in far western New York State and started stabbing him and took his eye out. So he's only got one eye left. And that's actually not, that's not really fun if you're used to seeing with two eyes to suddenly have to get used to seeing with one eye. And we don't know all the details of all the other wounds, but I'm sure people always like this stabbing thing today in the Netherlands. People always think, oh, it's the number of people who are dead that matters. That's the headline. 2 people dead. It's the people who are injured and are going to have to live with those injuries for the rest of their lives that are forgotten. Well, so he's given one eye to the cause of free speech, Salman Rushdie. And I don't blame him for suddenly saying, look, they've got these crazy Muslim students at Claremont McKenna. Who knows? They're now trying to rile up everyone to, who knows what one of them, we all know that, you can get in there And it only takes a few seconds to scrabble up on stage and plunge the knife in. He learned that the hard way. And I don't blame him for deciding, nah, you know, I don't really need to give a commencement address. That's the way it is. And Tommy Robinson doesn't. Tommy Robinson has paid a huge price. People think, oh, he's just doing this to make some money. You can't make any money. Nobody like Tommy Robinson can make any money out of this. All whatever, and you've lost your life. You're having to pay for security, horrendous amounts of security. And I would, what I would advise him normally in a normal situation would be to go to some country that speaks some other language where they've never heard of you, and you can live a quiet, obscure life. But the British government, if you think that it's coincidental that after the first judge says, okay, we're going to release him from prison, oh, wait a minute, just before you head for the checkout, we've got these other charges we've waited a year to bring. If you think that's coincidental, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn. I can't sell you that bridge because some Mexican ship sailed into it. Richard Borzyszewski, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Greetings, Mark. Here in the Dominion of Canada, we are to be honoured by the presence of King Charles III, who will read the throne speech to open the new session of Parliament. Yeah, this is happening. Is it Monday or Tuesday? The king, who's very sick and is much sicker than they're letting on, is nevertheless, he and the queen are flying in to read the speech from the throne in the Canadian Parliament to open the new session and then to fly more or less straight out again. He wouldn't be doing this if he weren't attaching a high priority to pushing back against all this 51st state stuff. What will be interesting about it will be the words that, because the throne speech is written by the government, so the words that are put in his mouth will be what matter. When it comes to, there will be an allusion, certainly, to Trump's regular routine references to annexing Canada. The question is how strong it will be. So this is going to be a point at which we will get a glimpse of the closeness between the King and his Canadian Prime Minister. Richard goes on to say, I was thinking it would be a great opportunity for him to confer a knighthood on our newly elected Prime Minister Mark Carney, as he does hold a British passport. Would he be eligible? In the days of yore, one had to slay a dragon or rescue a damsel in distress. Oh, like Lucy Connolly, to receive such an honour, but that criterion has passed. If a nondescript politician like Sir Keir Starmer qualifies, why not RPM? Your thoughts? Well, there was a kind of cranking up in Canadian hostility to titles at the time that that Conrad Black was recommended for a peerage. The UK Prime Minister recommended Conrad for a peerage, and the Canadian Prime Minister objected. And the rule is if the Queen gets conflicting advice from two prime ministers, the status quo is what she is obliged to accept. So if you've got somebody offering to make Conrad Black Lord Black and another guy wants to keep him as Mr. Black, then the Queen is obligated to keep him as Mr. Black. And that eventually all went to court and there were other rucks. And the reason Chrétien, who did that, made reference to the Nicol resolution, which is from a 107 years ago, I think it is, but it's just a resolution. It isn't binding on Parliament, and it certainly isn't binding on the sovereign. And since the Nicol resolution, Canadians have gotten not only knighthoods, but earldoms. So that in itself would not be an objection. It would have been easier, and I think he quite wanted to do this, is that I think Mark Carney wanted a knighthood when he retired from the Bank of England. And at that point, he could have he then could have become the first Canadian prime minister with a knighthood in office with a knighthood, just like Sir Keir is the first one since Sir Alec Douglas Hume. Mark Carney would have been the first since Sir Mackenzie Bowell or whoever it was. anyway, and would probably got on to be the first one since the 30s with an earldom too. But the thing is, what's the thing about this is, it's interesting, the language that the Canadian state is using about the king and queen is not language that Liberal prime ministers, even going back to, it's interesting, when the Queen died, and then whatever it was in the spring of 2023, it was the coronation, and Justin decided he didn't want to issue a specifically Canadian coronation medal for the King. And then, strangely enough, a year later, so a year after the coronation, the Privy Council of Canada decides it's going to issue a coronation medal, a year after the coronation. And in a country that, I mean, Canada's issued Jubilee medals and so forth of its own, but it has never issued a coronation medal. So you think, well, why are they doing this a year after the coronation? And it's because The king serves their purposes at the moment. That's the reason why the king is opening parliament. So right now, the Liberal Party is in the curious position of appearing to, you know, the way this is going to end up is the king will be so woke that that conservatives, who are usually the traditional monarchists, sour on the whole royal family, and it's the lefties who feel that he serves their purposes, he's useful to them. Anyway, I went a bit long on that, probably baffling to those of you beyond the Commonwealth realms. So we have one from Michael Cavino. Hi, Mark. I hope you're feeling better this week. Given the blizzard of lies concerning the cancer diagnosis of Joe Biden, I've been wondering what cocktail of drugs Dr. Feelgood Jill has been giving Joe since 2019 to keep him alive and her well-heeled lifestyle going. Thoughts? Great hearing you live every Wednesday afternoon. You remain the indispensable man. Yeah. This is... This plot twist, Trump got close to it, actually, in a tweet. You know, the dead husk of a moth-eaten sock puppet. That's what I said. I didn't just do the dementia gags. I said he was a sock puppet. What is the salient feature of a sock puppet? Somebody's hand is up him. So in other words, you may not know this. It may come as a big shock to you, just as it apparently came as a big shock to the American media, that they're shocked to find that there's dementia going on in the Oval Office. And they'd likewise be equally shocked to find that the Easter Bunny isn't real and that President Joe Biden isn't real. And so everything we are told is a lie. And sometimes it's an original lie, and sometimes it's a lie because the first lie is beginning to wobble a little, so we need to modify the original lie. And sometimes it's a lie that appears to be in direct contradiction with whatever the first or second lie was, but is necessary now to maintain it all. It is, and as I said, you're for a foreigner, You're particularly aware of it because American politics is like nothing else on earth. So you spend 2 years electing the head of your executive branch. That's not something the founders were in favor of. In the 19th century, it was an understanding that one did not, quote unquote, run for president. If your name wound up in nomination, you sat aloof from all the grubby politics and let the people decide. So campaigning in the early 19th century was not a thing you did. Now, we've just had the election. People, Tim Walz, he's looking very strong in Iowa. Yeah, they could do far worse than nominate Tim Walz because he's super connected. He's really in touch with what the average working stiff thinks. So Tim Walz, we've just done some preliminary polling and he's 2 points up in that. So you spend 2 years actively and the 2 years before that rather more sotto voce. Well, 2 points up in Iowa, but he's fallen back 4 points in New Hampshire. None of it matters if your president is a sock puppet. And that is why this is the big... No one denies that FDR, even in a wheelchair, was capable of exercising the function, at least until the fourth term. He was rather sick for however many weeks that managed to stagger on for. But in the first terms, two or three, he was an effective functioning president. Nobody deny. I don't agree with America. You know, most countries had a depression in the 30s. America had a great depression because of FDR. Likewise, I don't agree with much of what Woodrow Wilson did. Especially with regard to the peace conference and the right to self-determination and all that, which they seem to have forgotten in the multicultural thing. But there's no doubt that until he had his stroke, he was an effective president. Joe Biden on day one wasn't the president. Do you remember day one? I think this was coming back from the parade, returning to the White House. And he's approaching the door and there's a Marine at the door and Joe Biden doesn't seem cognizant of the Marine. So someone whispers in his earpiece, salute the Marine. So Biden turns to the Marine and says, salute the Marine. Then proceeds through the... He wasn't president on day one. So I don't know what... the thing about the drugs is they weren't able to keep him... make him function as president. So whatever cocktail of drugs is on, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It's a racket. And until you find out there's no provision in the Constitution for a puppet master. That role does not exist. There's not a commander-in-chief and then above him the puppet master-in-chief. That position does not exist in the United States Constitution. So we need to know who it was. And if it was a serious country, they would put him in jail for stealing the government, for stealing, to go back to Woodrow Wilson, the people's right to self-determination. This is Stein Online's Clubland Q&A, live around the planet. And here's the favourite part of the show. Everybody loves this part of the show because Mark Stein swings by just for 30 seconds. But he's going to tell you everything that's happening on our weekend music show. Go, Mark. Hey, this is Mark Stein on The Town this week. Songs across the century, songs around the world, from the continent and from the Commonwealth. Plus a Victorian number one and Gunga Din. Is certainly a better man than I, but is he a better man than Frank Sinatra? On The Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio. And 5 p.m. London time is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, or 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 12 to 4 Eastern time. That is 12 to 9 British summertime. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us return to your questions. Kelly Walter says, Mark, as a 70-year-old fellow cardiac patient with a quadruple bypass and five stents, I want to thank you. I love the word stent. I never heard it until Dick Cheney had his first stent. And now it's a big part of my life. And I remember asking my charming Provençal nurses, qu'est-ce que c'est le français pour stent? What is the French for stent? And Vanessa, my head nurse, said, stent? Le stent? Je pense que c'est le stent. Ce n'est pas la stent. Le stent. I hope I'm not laughing too much and shaking them loose. I want to thank you for continuing your celebration of our civilization, even as you cry out against its demise. What an amazing balance you've maintained. I eagerly await your doomsday chronicles each day they appear, and I greatly enjoy On the Town and Song of the Week as part of my cardiac rehab downtime. I'm working my way through Rick's flicks. What a treasure trove of cinema critique. That is Rick McGuinness, who, after our dear friend Kathy Shadle died, stepped in to cover Kathy's gig as our film critic. Kelly says, do you have a favourite movie? Mine would be The Man Who Would Be King, Sean Connery and Michael Caine's telling of a Rudyard Kipling adventure story. The Man Who Would Be King is a terrific story, and it's actually one of our tales for our time. So you can see how my version measures up to Sean Connery and Michael Caine. P.S. In the past, you've been confused by the name Kelly, thinking I may be female or even trans. Rest assured, I'm a grizzled old white male who still remembers. Well, that's no excuse, Kelly. There's all kinds of grizzled old white males who suddenly decide that they're women now. That one who's a four-star admiral or whatever. Meanwhile, keep the faith. There's a better life in Christ coming after this one. I know that, but I would still like this one to be a little bit better, if only for my kids' sake. You know, this is why the mainstreaming of the word remigration is interesting to me, because people who do the arithmetic know that if you shut the borders today and there was no more people came in from Somalia or Waziristan, you would still lose your country simply because of the people who are already here and the differential in birth rates. So that's why it's in these small signs like, oh, suddenly remigration is a word that people are using. These things are important. And the civilizational stuff, you know, like when I did the music special last week or the week before on the music we feature in Tales of Our Time, it's because all this stuff is going. Do you look at the contribution to civilization? And I mean, we find out, you know, hundreds of years. Oh yeah, it was the Muslims who invented ice cream or whatever. You know, but you go to any, even the more agreeable Muslim countries, and you think, and you know, where's the Mohammedan's Bach? Where's the Mohammedan's Shakespeare? Where's the Mohammedan's Rembrandt? There's no such thing. They're at war with. That's why they chop their heads off. If they find an orchestra like they did in Libya, they chop their heads off. That's what those guys are good at. So I am actually in a good mood. I think, you know, it's not just about a better life to come, but I'd like my kids. I don't want my kids to wind up living in an Islamized Western world. You know, the thing that made the most, when we used to do the show, I miss so much, but I'm not really up to it. When we used to do our midweek show with Leilani and Ava and Alexandra. And I used to love doing that show, but I remember Ava saying something. Ava's in her mid-20s. She has no memory of the Netherlands before they wrecked it. I do, because I'm, you know, 12 times Ava's age. So I remember before all the places I like got wrecked. And I think Ava had a kid a couple of months ago. And I think of what that, you know, right now on the present course, when that kid is my age, and even, in fact, when that kid is Ava's age, there isn't going to be anything recognizable as Europe. So it's about urgency. People are actually going to have to do something. And they're going, and all these people say, well, we've run the focus groups. And unfortunately, it looks like when you say the word, this word or that word, that people think you're a big racy racist. I liked Rupert Lowe, who was on some show with the BBC, whatever she is now, Emily Maitlis. And Emily Maitlis, he's doing something for grooming gangs, not like Emily Maitlis. Emily Maitlis is apparently indifferent to girls, white working class girls, because that's not her bag, becoming the sex slaves of Pakistani Muslim gangs for years on end, like our friend Samantha Smith, whose torment went on for... It's actually quite common. It wasn't just Samantha Smith, whose torment went on for over a decade, being raped for over a decade from the age of five. But it was also... It's amazing how many... it starts very young when you don't really know what's going on. And then it continues for years and years and years. So you have no memory of an existence before the grooming. It's amazing how many are in that situation. But anyway, because Rupert Lowe set up an inquiry, our pal Sammy Woodhouse is on the inquiry. So Emily Maitlis accuses him of making a ton of money out of it and says he's a racist because he's only concerned about Pakistani Muslims raping white working class girls. And he doesn't even bother. He just shrugs off the racist thing. You know, he doesn't care. It's all so bloody boring, right? It's normal. It's perfectly normal that countries, a functioning country, has a majority population. And as I said last week, I'm not even talking about browns and blacks and whatever here. I'm saying, you know, I like the way Denmark's full of Danes and Norway's full of Norwegians. That's a normal country. And when we look at it on a wider scale, as Ava said in her speech, you know, Africa is for the Africans. We would think it odd if, say, all the Frenchmen moved to Nigeria and became the demographically dominant population in Nigerian schools. So Africa's, we accept that Africa is for the Africans. And that's true in the American context. That black mayor of New Orleans, who said that New Orleans has always been a chocolate city. But after the tsunami or whatever it was, the floods, a ton of people bailed on the city, and so the demographics shifted. Well, that's like a freak of nature. When it's your own government deciding to turn a chocolate city into a non-chocolate city, which is what's gone on in most countries of the West, as Ava put it very well, she said, we accept that Africa is for Africans, Asia is for Asians, but Europe is apparently not for Europeans. Do go and have a look at that speech and let me know what you think about it. Melanie DePuma writes, in the last few years, Mark, Time magazine published a book review called The White Supremacist Origins of Exercise and six other surprising facts about the history of US physical fitness. And The Guardian published an article called Getting Fit is Great, but it could turn you into a right-wing jerk. I was reminded of this recently, and now I'm curious. How many very Brexity push-ups are you willing to confess to doing out in the woods next to your photocopier? Well, if that's the... If that's... the thesis, then I must be one of the most left-wing guys on the planet, because I'm incredibly feeble. You know, I was sort of wrestling with a parasol the other day. Since my crise cardiaque, my heart attacks, I become totally feeble. As I said, I was wrestling with a parasol the other day, and the parasol was winning. The parasol was kicking my ass. It'd be nothing on pay-per-view. No one wants to see Mark Stein versus the parasol, because they all know the parasol will win. And when my daughter came to see me just not long after my heart attacks, and was thinking that, you know, she was thinking very considerately, so she didn't want to do any demanding hikes, you know, in case I fell over and died from a massive heart attack at the top of the mountain where cell service is incredibly bad. So we went for a walk on a plateau, completely flat. And I was dead after, you know, 130 yards or whatever. So she thinks that, okay, so like walking on a level surface is too demanding for him. So, okay, I'll figure out a walk that's all downhill, which she did between, you know, two villages. So a walk that's all downhill. And I walked downhill for a little longer than walking on the plateau. It was like maybe 270 yards or something. And then I was all done in and couldn't go on. So I am not, there may be these incredibly fit right-wing monsters out there, but on that basis, I am a big socialist panty waste, Melanie. It's been sort of difficult trying to get myself back. I that because I bore on about it all the time, but these last 2 years have been pretty terrible. Queen of the Jungle, possibly not her real name, says, "Greetings and salutations, dear Mark. As always, I hope that you are well." I thank you for that, Queen. "It never ceases to amaze me how during the decades that I've been a fan, your prescience prevails in so many areas of public events and discourse. Therefore, I would welcome your commentary on the following. Take, for example, your ongoing coverage of the UK grooming gang rapist scandal. One would think that after all you've revealed and shone a light on, things couldn't get much worse. But lo and behold, meet Rotherham's new mayor, Rukhsana Ismail. Born in Britain, of Pakistani heritage, she now holds the highest civic office in the very town that became infamous for one of the worst child abuse scandals in modern UK history. This is the same Rotherham where at least 1,400 children..." No. Don't ever use that. That's from Professor J, Alexis J, from her report over a decade ago. And a decade ago, as Sammy Woodhouse and I were talking about during the Mark Stein cruise, I first met Sammy. I'd gone to Rotherham and I was staying in this totally freaky, weird hotel. And I asked Sammy and her a couple of friends of hers if they'd like to come over and meet me in the hotel I was staying at. And they said, sure. Sammy tells me when she gets to the hotel that this is one of the many places in Rotherham she was raped in. So she's such an amazing... She's a really, truly amazing person. So I've quite accidentally invited her over for lunch at the scene of one of her rapes. Now, admittedly, you know, it's Rotherham. So just as in Hollywood, they have these tour buses so you can take a tour and see where, you know, whoever it is, Julia Roberts lives or Humphrey Bogart lives, whoever, you know. So the Home of the Stars tour, you know, Sammy could easily buy a bus and be running around Rotherham, taking tourists to scenes in which those girls were raped in. That's the kind of town it is. But it wasn't 1,400 children even then. That's 10 years ago now. Sammy thought that number was complete rubbish. Nationwide, it's far more than that, because, as I said, when I before I left Rotherham, I went to that shopping centre that they'd been talking about where it's still going on, and I saw it going on. So it's not 1,400. It's in the totality is may even be up to a million by now, because it's going on in all these towns. Anyway, this is the same Rotherham, you see, says Queen of the Jungle, where mostly white working class girls were systematically groomed, raped, trafficked and tortured over decades by gangs of predominantly Muslim men of Pakistani descent. And now, in a cruel twist, that would be called satire if it weren't real, the town's new first citizen is a woman who shares the same ethnic and religious background as many of the perpetrators involved in that horrifying abuse. So in today's Britain, the town that let thousands of girls be sacrificed on the altar of political correctness now installs leadership that reflects the very demographic authorities were too afraid to confront. Next, another subject near and dear to many of us, and one that we don't seem to discuss very often unless it's in the context of the Mann litigation, and that is the green scam, climate change debacle. In fact, I just came across my copy of Climate Change the Facts, signed by none other than Mark Stein himself. The chapter you wrote was Global Warming's Glorious Ship of Fools, and of course it is just as relevant today as it was back in 2015. If you have time, maybe you can opine on our current situation with the net zero freaks trying to block out the sun, the chemtrails, etc. This isn't progress, it's betrayal, and the world needs to pay attention. It's all about control. Net zero is about control. 15-minute cities is about control. If your car switches off when you've gone more than 15 minutes from where you live, as mine did when I attempted to drive it across the Hungary-Ukraine border, then something that was once a symbol of the individual citizen's liberation, his freedom from slow public transit, and the substitution of his own automobile that could drive hours in any direction. It's about control. The kind of control, the kind of society for which, because basically all the truly transformative, in a good sense, inventions were made in the 19th century. You know, the telephone, the electric light bulb, the internal combustion engine. And now, a little more than a century later, we're actually trying to uninvent the great liberating qualities that they brought about. That's the purpose of it. And one way to establish control is to make sure that you're poorer, that your lives are smaller, that you're colder, because it becomes more difficult to afford to heat your homes and all the way. And it becomes increasingly unstable. There's blackouts and all the rest of it. And you can't just get into your car and flee, because your car is basically a giant computer on wheels and it switches off after 15 minutes. So that's what that is. Rotherham is just the reality. You call the mayor the first citizen. I'm not sure that's a term people use for a mayor outside America, but you know, you could argue that Lord Ahmed from Rotherham is also a first citizen of a type. You look at this thing, Rotherham. You look at how hard Sammy works so hard. You know, she's a survivor, but she has to survive not only the rape, but the facilitation of the rape by the entire British establishment. Meanwhile, people from the rapists' community, like this mayor, like Lord Ahmed, an actual rapist, like someone else, they put Sammy on an official government inquiry committee in which one of the rapists was also on the committee. So she would have wound up sitting, if it hadn't been for COVID and it all being done by Zoom call, she would have been on a committee investigating child rape on which they've given one of the child rapists a place on the committee. They've all done very well because they're the future. Every year, more and more towns in England acquire a Muslim mayor. I'm with Eva Vladingerbroek on this. I'd like England to be for the English. That doesn't mean, you know, if you were to exercise that strictly on bloodlines, I wouldn't qualify. I wouldn't get in there. But actually, even if they were to do that, because I think, you know, emigrating to Western nations is a privilege. If you want to go and live in Sudan, go for it. Because Sudan's a lousy dump to live in by comparison with France or Italy. But I would like the basic understanding to be that, as Eva said, just as Africa is for Africans and Asia is for the Asians, Europe is for the Europeans. And in a sense, it's been a reverse imposition of the American nation of immigrants model, which isn't actually true for the United States. The greatest period in U.S. history, the period when it emerged as a global superpower and won the Second World War, was the immigration pause that was instituted under the Coolidge administration from 1925 to the Ted Kennedy bill in 1965. It's not normal. The magic soil theory that, oh, just by setting foot in America, you become American. Just by setting foot in Canada, you become Canadian. And even more absurdly, just by setting foot in Slovenia, you become Slovene. Just by setting foot in Finland, you become Finnish. It's complete rubbish. You're importing people from incompatible cultures and somehow, despite all the evidence, expecting it to work out. So in Rotherham, the girls, the white working class girls, the girls who got raped, the girls who, like Sammy Woodhouse, got dangled off a balcony by Muslim men who would gladly have dropped her to the pavement below if it had turned them on sufficiently. The guys who do that, all these mysterious honor killers, because actually the falling from the balcony thing, that's another of these things that used to be quite rare. Now to the so-called honor killing, the easiest kind of honor killing to do in a Western nation is to drop the girl who wants to lead a more Western lifestyle off the balcony. It's awful what we've done. It's awful what we've done. And the idea now is that somehow it's been accepted. Oh, the vast majority of Muslims don't stab little girls. Okay, you're saying that so confidently, Prime Minister. I assume you wouldn't say that so confidently if you didn't have research on it. So what percentage is it that stab little girls? Is it, 35%? Is it 6%? Is it 0.001%? Because it doesn't really matter, you ass. Because if you import another however many Muslims, then you're importing more stabbers of little girls. Do you know, there's something... I'll leave this as a final... As I said, I'm in a good mood because I think the young, I think those guys from Germany who were forbidden to leave their crap hole country, like I said earlier today, where's Bomber Harris when you need him to just reduce the current iteration of the German state to rubble? Well, he isn't around anymore. But that state a state that won't let its citizens leave to attend a conference is not a free society. So I congratulate them on getting their no exit orders from the state and then sneaking over at least two frontiers, national frontiers, into Italy to attend that conference near Milan. That's the kind of spirit that we are going to need. Because the other kind of spirit is this one. To commemorate Dunkirk. You've all seen Dunkirk. What was the film called? Finest Hour? Okay, so fine, in the self-mythologizing of nations, Dunkirk was the finest hour. The Dunkirk anniversary just concluded was the crappiest hour. All the, you know, Dunkirk, if you've seen the film, the little boats, the flotilla of little boats that sailed across the English Channel to rescue the beleaguered British Expeditionary Force and a big chunk of the French army and ferry them back across the water to England. It would have been a big blow at a very dark hour if that had not happened. Okay, so it's time to commemorate it. So they get all these little boats together and they find people in the little boats to take them across the English Channel to Dunkirk. And then both the French and the United Kingdom governments tell them they have to get out of the way because they're bringing over a dinghy full of invaders, of so-called migrants, of young military age men. And there's a 1 mile exclusion zone around the dinghy. So all the little flotilla of little boats commemorating Dunkirk. That's the history of the United Bloody Sodding Useless Awful Piss Wankarsery Kingdom in a single anecdote. Well, whatever it was, 80 years ago. Yeah, little boats going to Dunkirk and getting all the British soldiers off and bringing them back to England. Great, great, great. Great stuff. Oh, now we're reenacting it, only this time one buggering dinghy. And the French and United Kingdom governments both tell all those little boats the dinghy. Why has the dinghy got a 1 mile exclusion zone? I would have loved it if all those little boats heading to Dunkirk had done what those eight guys heading to the remigration conference had done and just found a way to utterly subvert it. But as it is, it's a bleak comment on what's left of a once great nation. I've said this before. I don't, you know, that if these nations die very quickly, as some of them are doing before our eyes, I'll remember the way they were. But I don't want to have to do that. And I think Ava and her chums are right, you know, that you're not going to get out of this by waiting for a big heroic figure. Because sometimes there are genuinely heroic figures, but more often there's people posing as heroic figures who actually don't want to move the needle on any of this stuff that matters. You know, complete charlatans like Bojo, who doesn't have a conservative bone in his body. He's basically just a giant penis. He's a big flabby penis walking around impregnating women and betraying his voters. You don't want to. This is going to be something that's going to be done at the ground level or not at all. Or otherwise, because I tell you something else too, that if you don't reverse this, then this thing in just 3 minutes from Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam today, two people dead. Okay? That's happening now. Once the demographic balance has tipped over, once we're at the point de bascule, which we're approaching, the point de bascule, the tipping point, when it tips like the seesaw and you're going in the other direction, There's going to be a lot more stabbings. There's going to be, if you think there's not enough stabbings, if you think there's not enough rapes, then diversity is great. But otherwise, Ava and her chums are right. That, and this is so weird and abnormal. Oh, yes, yes, Europe. Oh, Europe, Europe will be so... What have Europeans contributed to? Oh, yeah, a few symphonies and old masters and a cathedral here and there and some great novels and whatever. But it's not like all the machetes we have. Now, have you seen the prices of that new machete warehouse on the edge of town? It's bollocks, and it's got to be resisted at every... There's no saviour coming for you. The saviours are generally charlatans, so you got to get off your ass and resist it at every level, which is why, as I said, I'm forming a paramilitary organisation. That's going to do it for today. I've gone on a bit too long, but do stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. It's a very popular feature. I've noticed it coming up more and more in our 8th birthday emails that we've been getting. Laura rounds up the internet as only she can. It's a very distinctive take on the last week's online content, and that will be with us tomorrow. Our Mark Stein Club 8th birthday observances continue with our 70th Tale for Our Time. That's quite a library. That's quite an archive, including The Man Who Would Be King, which came up earlier, Rudyard Kipling. That's probably illegal on the BBC now. Three Men on the Bubble is our 70th tale. Jerome K. Jerome, the latest episode airs in a couple of hours, and we're rocketing towards this weekend's finale. And do check out our first two Mark Stein shows on video since my third heart attack in Trieste a couple of years ago. Didn't really like the way I looked. But we had great guests, Sammy Woodhouse, Samantha Smith, Alison Pearson. That is a powerful show on a subject we've been talking about in the last hour. And then Naomi Wolf, Lawrence Fox, Dan Wootton on our second show, also very powerful, and also on a subject we talk about, free speech. So I hope you'll want to check those out. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, well, we've made it 8 years, and we're looking forward to more. So come on in. The water's fine. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.